Well, good day, everybody. This is our eighth Laws of the Soul webinar commentary, and we are working still in the Law of Sacrifice, and we are on page 103 of Esoteric Psychology, Volume 2. DK has talked here about the theme of esoteric astrology. Psychology, rather. Did I say astrology? Okay. When rightly understood, all that we have been studying would explain the Saturnian influence, as I have explained, the forced choice, the planet of forced choice, the cessation of rebellion under the Martian influence, and our planetary logos, too, has the psychology of the divine rebel. The building of the Antiskarana, which releases a man from control of personality life into the higher states where pain, sorrow, agony, difficulty, and so forth are not known as we know them. The evocation of group consciousness, which is triadal consciousness. The consequent negation of pain and sorrow in the worlds beyond duality, and the entrance into nirvana and the beginning of the real way, which is the way of higher evolution. All right, that takes us to the point where we are ready to begin. The law of sacrifice means also the relinquishing of gain. Well, as a spirit, really, you can gain nothing. We can only gain in the worlds of relativity, and it is a relative gain. The one and complete deity can neither be added to nor subtracted from. The normal mathematical methods don't work. It can't be divided. It can't be multiplied. It can only be exactly what it is. But at least in these relative worlds in which we must cyclically and forever perforce live and have forever perforce lived. That's an amazing thought if you think of it. That time has been completely negated. And in what we call forever, we have been present. The true we, not the individual gathering of energies and forces in a certain arrangement which we identify as ourself, but the very essence has been forever present. Forever. Forever. Certainly negates any definite unit of time, even, as I've been saying recently, in a half-mad state, a Googleplexian of universes, a one with Googleplex zeros after it. A Googleplexian of universes is negated as well. It becomes nothing but an ultimate negligibility. It's as if no time has passed at all, and in eternal duration, well, no time has passed at all. In a way, all time has passed, but no time has passed. We have to get ourselves into that state of realization where the relative world is seen for what it is, just a tiny, well, can't even use the word tiny, it's a dimensionless, recurring point. So all self point, and the points are as nothing. And so the sum of them all is virtually nothing. The ultimate negligibility as close to zero as possible without being zero. Always less than any quantity. It's almost as if all these many universes have been no definite quantity at all. But I fear I shall go off on a tangent. So the law of sacrifice also means the relinquishing of gain. This is the basic theme of the Bhagavad Gita, which DK said, have in your possession if you're a disciple. In that treatise on the soul and its unfoldment, we are taught to perform action without attachment. The song Celestial, there's so many different versions of it, translations, some of them poetic. I think there is, by Sir Edwin Arnold, one of the early theosophists, a poetic rendition of this song Celestial. We are to perform action without attachment. Indeed, this universe, this ultimate negligibility, this great and recurrent playful illusion, we cannot be attached to it. We cannot be attached to any form we have taken. We have relinquished infinitudinously all forms and forever, a mind-boggling thought. So if we perform action without attachment, we lay the foundation for later relinquishings, which can be effected without pain and loss, because sense of loss, because we have acquired the power latent ever within ourselves. And we would say that due to our nature as spirit, to detach ourselves from achieved possessions. We already are all that it is possible to be, essentially. And that cannot be added to. So, whatever we possess is in trust for the working out of the divine purpose of this universe. Well, it's easier said than done. The philosophy is there, of course. And ever we must relinquish so that we can center our attention in that which we ever are and ever have been. The trouble is, when we do not relinquish our attachment to our actions and to our acquisitions, we become preoccupied with them. And we fail then to realize our true identity as the one and imperishable. And that, of course, is the real sacrifice of reality, which is unnecessary at our stage of evolution. So this law, the law of sacrifice, works out in many ways, and it is not possible to do more than indicate a few of those general significances which embody the major lessons of every disciple. So the law of sacrifice might also be called the law of relinquishment of gain. Well, we have to realize this too shall pass, and what are we holding in our hands now that we have gained in a prior universe? The entire universe as a field of expression has become a nullity. It no longer exists, and everything within it has been dissolved into that which we are. So what have we acquired? Is it possible for the internal spirit to acquire anything? Only in relative terms and within a relative universe is it possible to relatively acquire something. And even that, all acquisition will be dissolved into that which we truly and essentially are at the ultimate pralaya, the Maha Pralaya. I'd like to maybe make a little abbreviation there. U-P-R-A. And what I would call this is the ultimate pralaya. And that is when the entirety of the universe and all the multiple levels which people call other universes, all of that is reabsorbed into that which we ever are. Well, how many times have we, the one identity, been through this? infinitudinous times. You can't even really say infinitudinous times. You have to say infinitudinously. We have been through the dissolution of universes. Infinitudinously. Forever. Time after time. Countless times. Infinitudinously. And so we should be well accustomed forever to the habit of relinquishment. It is forced upon us, really, and it can also be voluntary, and at the stage of the ultimate pralaya, the one being voluntarily enters into a state of reabsorption. Well, I've said every universe is really a condition of ultimate forgetfulness. We enter blindly and devoid of any memory of the infinite cycles which have gone on before. It is a self-negation. The universe is really a self-negation. And by the self, I mean the one absolute reality. It's a one as far as possible from that which we are. But anyway, those are philosophical ideas behind the thought that we must relinquish gain. There will be relative gain, and we will all benefit from it, but the little ego, the lower ego, will hold on to apparent gain at the cost of ignorance and the cost of failure to progress. Well, here are these relinquishments. First, the soul must relinquish the personality. We might say, give up identification with it. For ages, the soul has identified itself. Well, the soul, the immersed, monadic, egoic consciousness, immersed in the dense physical body of the planetary logos. For ages, the soul has identified itself with the lower personal self, and through the agency of that lower self has gained experience and acquired much knowledge. The accumulation of registrations regarding how things work, how things relate, the function of everything. The time has come when that agency is no longer dear to the soul, and their respective positions are reversed, and all of this is correlated. Reversal is correlated with the reversal of the wheel, as it is called. And the, what can we say, you know, return of the salmon to its place of origin. And it is analogously a dangerous return. Everyone makes it in time in a reincarnated version of oneself, but at first one may not be successful. And so many are the fish that are not successful, battered, eaten by bears, trapped in pools, not able to go on. Think about what that jump must be over some of those waterfalls, small waterfalls, the tremendous effort required to return to the place of origin. But anyway, we have an instrument here, and we have held this instrument dear for millions of years, but it must become truly instrumental. Instrument must become truly instrumental. And not that with which we identify ourselves. No longer is the soul identified with the personality, but the personality becomes identified with the soul, or that the consciousness within the personality, which is really the soul in incarnation, becomes identified with the soul on its own plane and loses its separate and separative quality and position. So another way of putting this is the soul in incarnation must learn to identify with the soul on its own plane. And that's the process in which we are, so many of us are presently engaged. Okay. I seem to have an audio connection which wants to disconnect itself, excommunicate itself periodically, and I have to be aware of that. If I'm off in my thoughts and not looking, then I could be running a silent movie here. Well, hopefully that has not happened too frequently. So no longer is the soul identified with the personality, but the personality has become identified with the soul and loses its separate quality and position. So we begin to wake up through disidentification to the realization that all that we have and are attached to is just a perception. The body of perception, the astral vehicle, the lower mind, none of these is what we more essentially are. Although at root, of course, all things are the one thing, the one being. But we separate ourselves from our instruments and we seek that higher point, which is a higher point of consciousness, where being is realized more fully than it can possibly be at first in the lower worlds. All that has been acquired through age-long struggle and strife, through pain and pleasure, through disaster and satisfied desire, and notice that these pairs of opposites are the means of acquisition. The pairs of opposites are the means of acquisition. All that has been acquired in this way, and all that the wheel of life, which has turned ceaselessly, has brought to the possession of the soul, all has to be relinquished, let's say, no longer held, to reinforce the illusory center, the lower ego. Life for the disciple becomes then a series of detaching processes until he has learnt the lesson of renunciation. All then is lost and gain. These three produce the merging. All then is lost and gain. This is in the Angel of the Present stanzas for the second ray. Well, when we have something at hand, we can use it. It is always available to us. We can express through it. And unfortunately, sometimes we identify with it such that when it disappears, we feel reduced, compromised, in some way, lessened. But again, the age-old idea, to those who give all is given. And whatever has been gained, even if it temporarily seems to be to disappear, it will be restored. It's just that we have to somehow remember this during the moment of detachment, and when something appears to be taken out of our hands, away from our access, out of sight, so that we no longer have connection with it and control over it and the possibility of expression through it. It's temporarily removed. All then is removed. The light of summer enters in, and the darkened crannies of the mind see light. So along this second ray path particularly, well, that's the ray, major ray for our planet at this time, and maybe for our solar system altogether, at all times, there will be temporary removals of that which we held dear. So we have to realize that the riches of the universe are ours, if we have the faith, to to move forward to their acquisition, but we cannot hold too tightly to that which we have already attained, but we are to use what we have attained to attain more. And the only way this can really happen is if we use what we have attained to serve the whole, which will then bestow upon us that which is yet missing. Missing within the context of a universe, of course. Nothing is really missing. You say, well, you know, what is missing in the absolute? What is missing in the infinity of infinities, in that being that has no second, no other? Nothing is missing. Everything is present. Everything that ever could be and was, everything that could ever possibly be, ever, is already present. So this is the infinitudinous deity that we essentially are. So what is this sequence that leads to learning the lesson of why renounce? Well, you know, so that one may be freer to express the divine plan and the divine purpose. One's hands and mind are not encumbered by one's possessions. That's why to renounce. We hold on for dear life to certain little things as if the universe did not have the possibility of replacing them with incredible bounty, with great abundance, far more than that which we have relinquished. It's kind of a lack of faith, you know. We don't want to give up what we have, including our body and so forth, under the impression that if we give up, we will never be resupplied with anything of equal value. In fact, we are resupplied with that which is of far greater value. So here, this law of sacrifice does indeed lead to betterment and improvement, because there comes the time when we do give up that which we have been grasping for something of greater value, even if we may not clearly see what that something is and only realize it later after we have courageously renounced, relinquished, given up that which we have been clinging to. So a series of detaching processes, that is what discipleship is, until the lesson is learnt of renunciation. And what is this lesson? To give to the whole all that has been acquired by the apparent part. So it's not for us, the part does not acquire for the part. Only in the beginning stages of evolution does the part acquire for the part. The part acquires for the whole. The part, which is the whole in disguise, acquires for the whole. And if we understand this method of acquisition, then the bounty of the universe will be sequentially, properly, wisely bestowed upon us. And all should be given so that we may give again. The sequence is first dispassion, then discrimination, and finally detachment. Well, this seems to begin with the emotional vehicle. Dispassion in relation to the emotional vehicle. Discrimination in relation to the mind. Detachment in relation to the entire personality. And there are other factors here, you know. We could add to this discipline and decentralization. Decentralization. Yeah. Well, and because the discipline of the body oftentimes comes first, then the dispassion, where we are not moved by desire to acquire, that the discrimination between that which is truly of value and that which is not. I would say decentralization, in which we no longer see the personality as the center of our field of consciousness, and then detachment from that personality. And this the soul accomplishes. The soul in incarnation detaches from its previous identifications. So we have to go through these D's. The D is the number four, at least in our language. And four is form, and we are learning how to pull back from attachment to form and not to hold it so dear that we forget that of which it is really an expression. On these three words must all disciples meditate: dispassion, discrimination, and finally, at last, detachment. Okay. I think I want to make this a bit bigger. That'll do it. Right. We have to meditate on these words and the extent to which they are part of our way of life. And it wouldn't hurt to meditate upon discipline and decentralization as well. If they are ever to reap the fruits of sacrifice, and what are the fruits of sacrifice? Betterment. Betterment. The major fruit. Improvement. These are the fruits of sacrifice. So, then from the Bhagavad Gita, this quote is brought forth: having pervaded the worlds with a fraction or a fragment of myself, I remain. Such is the theme of the soul's endeavor, and such is the spirit which must underlie all creative work. We, the creator, cannot be too closely identified with that which we create, or we suffocate ourselves. So we will suffocate if, as a soul in incarnation, we identify too closely with that which we have created. In this thought lies the clue to the symbol of the law of sacrifice, a rosy cross with a bird flying over it, and that is a golden bird, which is presumably the liberated soul consciousness. Maybe DK has another idea about this. This is the loved cross, and this is interesting, rose being the color of affection, but I would say that, yes, affection, and affection is related, affection related to the sixth ray. And already, however, the cross is not red in that sense. In other words, the desire has somewhat loosened, I suppose. And the quality of love and the sense of a larger whole represented by the white is penetrating the red of the cross. But anyway, as DK is seeing this, the loved cross, well, we have affection. We love or have affection for form and matter. Or maybe I should just call it matter form. Of course, it can be the black cross and the old rugged cross, and much to represent the obdurate, resistant nature of matter. But as long as we love the cross, we cannot be free. So the rosy cross, in the sense that the Tibetan is using it here, has to be overturned if we are to move out into great and wider life, as some of the old commentaries instruct us. Affection is of the emotion, is not the same as love. I think it should be said that affection is of the emotions and is not the same as love. And the bird, when the cross is overturned, well, I suppose the bird can perch upon the cross at first. But when the cross is overturned, after that long experience of the long and narrow tunnel, which is such a dire experience, then the bird can fly free in time and space and understand the relativity of time and space and their essential unreality. In a way, there is neither time nor space. There is eternal duration, and there is non-locality. Everything here. Can you ever hear without a there? Well, not really, but let's just say everything immediately present. So where's then space? All things and states are immediately present. So where then is space? And all times are now in eternal duration. So where then is time? We can't talk about time when any hugest amount of time is negated into an infinitesimal. And my mathematician friend in Germany tells me there are many kinds of infinitesimals, which is a mind-boggling thought, but I'm talking of the ultimate infinitesimal, which I also call the ultimate negligibility. So I think I'll put that down maybe for the first time. Ultimate infinitesimal is the ultimate negligibility. Right. But negligibility. Have to learn how to spell here. Ultimate. The ultimate infinitesimal is the ultimate negligibility. And we do fly free from our usual identifications with time and space. We do seek freedom from that upon which we are crucified, but we re-crucify ourselves or submit to re-crucification. Ignorantly, we've been crucified upon the common cross. Deliberately, we allow crucifixion upon the fixed cross in order to cultivate the soul and the great serving beings who give all in the spirit of sacrifice. They voluntarily crucify themselves upon the cardinal cross. And all of this within the boundary of the one about whom naught may be said. So the first relinquishment was of the personality. So first relinquishment, soul relinquishes the personality. The second, the soul has also to relinquish not only its tie and its gain through contact with the personal self, but it has to most definitely relinquish its ties with other personal selves. Personal selves. This is not to say that one cannot be related soul to soul or spirit, and I want to say as spirit. And, you know, this discussion of relinquishment is very similar to the destructive processes through which one must pass in preparation to fulfill Rule 11. You know, let the group together, what is it? move the fire within the jewel and the lotus into the triad, and let them find the word which will carry out this task. So this is before this rule, which pertains to the fourth initiation of a group, certain forms of destruction have to take place. The destruction of personality ties is one of them, the destruction of recognition, desire for recognition, and learning the meaning of occult silence. This is another form. The first couple of destructions have very much to do with the personality itself. Well, all of them, in a way, do. And they seem to be repeated here. He elaborates them perhaps a bit more in the rays and the initiations. But so the soul has also to relinquish its tie and its gain through contact, yes, but it has most definitely to relinquish its ties to other personal selves. And, you know, one of the prominent disciples in DK's group, he had a keynote to his life. It was called Freedom from Ties. Freedom from Ties. So at least the personal self, the phenomenal self. No ties with the phenomenal self. It must learn to know and to meet other people only on the plane of soul. And this, of course, is the second step, and eventually it may be something even more drastic. But how is this done? We must not become preoccupied or fascinated with the vehicles of others. What a mind, what a sentient nature, what a body, you know, what a personality. No. We're looking for some collection of quality behind all that. We seek the collection of quality behind that which is the obvious human being. So we try to meet others as souls and on the plane of soul, as if we could see through the other planes that are presented to us, see through the fires of mind and through the seas of the astral nature and through the desert of the physical nature, as if we could see through and beyond and really feel the presence of the soul, the deeper identity in every person. So we could say we detect the deeper identity in each and all. Maybe not yet the deepest identity, which is identicality, which is spirit itself. But at least we are detecting the soul identity, and that would be a great improvement. In this lies, for many disciples, a hard lesson to relinquish their ties from other personal selves, and yet even some of the masters have married. So what is the nature of their relationship to their spouse? It has to be not that of the personality at all. And this lies, for many a disciple, a hard lesson. They may care little for themselves and may have learned much personal detachment. In other words, the states, the personality states, which they experience do not mean so much to them and do not captivate their attention. They are soul-focused with respect to their own lower process. Little may they cherish the gain of contact with the lower personal self. So this is another way of saying that they do not care for the satisfactions of the lower personal self. They are learning to transcend all that and may have transcended to a great degree, but their love for their children, their family, their friends, and intimates is for them of supreme importance, and that love holds them prisoner in the lower worlds. But Into the worlds of form, that power to draw to oneself must someday fail to penetrate. So in what manner do they love their children, their family, their friends, their intimates as personalities? Or do they see really in every one of them the soul development, and do they feed the soul development? Or can they see and feed the soul development of their intimates? This would be another step. And then it would be the gain of the soul, which for them was of greatest importance no matter what happened to the personality. There has to be a knowledge of, at least faith of, in the immortality of the inner consciousness, and they have to see what is being gained by the inner consciousness. There may be loss in the world. It's always difficult to see loss in the lives of one's children and see what manner of gain may have occurred through that loss. It's such a scorpionic factor that there should be loss in order to be gain. They do not stop to recognize that their love is primarily love for the personalities and only secondarily love for the souls. So can we treat our intimates as souls? That is the question. Can we treat our intimates as souls, as points of consciousness on a higher plane, and even later as a divine center of consciousness? Can we do that? And we have to test ourselves. You know, DK had some students in his groups who really couldn't do that. There was one woman who, I suppose, she had cancer rising. I can really relate to it. And she treated her children, even though they were grown-up people, maybe as if they were children, and was always concerned about them, probably always calling them, and so forth. And DK chastened her for that. You know, she said they were grown up. She had to leave them alone in that sense. So, you know, think about the way you are related to people and see whether you are concentrated upon the divine center or upon the spiritual center on the higher mental plane, the soul, or whether you are looking at them primarily as personalities and concentrating upon the condition of their vehicles. It probably would be quite revealing. So upon this rock, many disciples are for lives broken. And I suppose especially, well, I can't say exclusively, but those upon the soft line rays tend to be more attached in that way, until the time comes when through pain and suffering and the constant losing of that which they so much cherish, the passing on and passing away of that which they so much cherish, it is inevitable, if not in other ways, then at least through death, their love enters into a newer and higher and truer phase. Newer, higher, truer. And we can see if we have children, you know, whether our love for them has progressed from a lower phase to something now which is a higher and truer phase. Can we begin to detect the soul almost from the beginning and do that which nurtures the soul rather than panders to the welfare of the parent welfare, anyway, of the personality? They rise above the personal and find again, after felt loss, no real loss, and suffering, those whom they now love as souls. That's so interesting, because he qualifies the word loss. This is felt loss, but not real loss. And, you know, all the grieving at the graveside and on the battlefield, and as those are taken away from us, we find out they are restored. who can take life? Can one take life? Says DK, I think not. So the permanence of every unit of life is a great principle which we must understand. How many forms have we manifested, even in this particular universe or in this solar system? Thousands? That point of consciousness, that emanation which we are manifesting through all those forms. Those forms are gone. Are we gone? No. Here we are. Well, the last universe came to an end. We were there. We were it. And so did all the universes preceding it, cyclically. The emergent ultimate negligibilities. The point emerging, the one point containing all points. It's almost like, you know, what can I say? Here's a great field of nothing, and in it a point appears. And around that point a circle. It dissolves back to the nothing. And endlessly, thus it is so. Well, are we grieving for what we lost in the last universe and the universe itself? It just depends on the degree to which we find ourselves as a internal volatile essence, one that's capable of flying out of confinement, changing our perceptions at will, seeing the other worlds at will, flying away from the magnetism which holds the essence perforce in a condition of bondage. The more we can come and go in our body, from our body and back to our body, the more we realize our own indestructibility, and then we realize the indestructibility of others, and then we will be willing to love them as souls and to see them come and go as they must, attending only or primarily to that which is the gain in understanding and capacity for that center of consciousness, the soul. This is, then, an impersonal attitude. It's not a cold attitude. It can be very loving. But at least it realizes what the human being is and not what it seems to be. So then, finding those who are lost and all that they cherish on a higher turn of the spiral, finding again after felt loss those again, who now they love as souls, this is the reward of detachment. Just look at who your familiars are right now. How have you known them in the past? How do you feel you know them now? Are you still, as they say, hanging on for dear life or hanging on for dear form? Or are you able to sense the inner reality of every person, and therefore able to be transpersonal? Are you able to do that? That is the question. Well, then they realize that there has been gain and not loss. They've gained the soul, and that only that which was illusory, ephemeral, and untrue, simply a perception, has disappeared. The real man has been gained and can never be lost again. And this is the, we can say that for those holding so strongly to the form, they may have been ignoring the real man. I'm remembering, is it in the Thornton Wilder's play, Our Town? Is her name Emily? Well, anyway, she dies. She dies, she's a young woman, and she's granted the wish to return for a single day to some point in her earlier life, into her family, and she has the consciousness of where she's been, but everybody else is in a trance and carrying on things just the way they always did, and she wants them to awaken, but they cannot. They can barely see or hear her. They take her for granted, you see. And they don't really see her for what she is. She's just, you know, my daughter, whatever, just a family member, conventionally perceived. She's not the real soul, the real person. She returns as a soul, really. She wants to be seen as a soul. But, you know, you can never go back. This seems to be the case. So after we lose... Okay, so we say that after we lose the unreal, time and time again, we gain the real. Have you thought, you know, those who are close to you now, maybe they've been close to you in the past. Maybe you've lost them in the past, apparently. Their form has faded out, died, and they've left. They separated from you in some way. Here they are again, on a higher turn of the spiral. It's all a very benevolent system, really, isn't it? And we have to realize what real sacrifice is and how it always will restore the real. True sacrifice will always see to the restoration of the real. It never robs one of the real, only of the illusory expressions of the real. Well, philosophically, again, of course, we can acquiesce to that idea, but do we actually live that? Well, time and time again, we're given the opportunity to live that, and I suppose when Pluto is strong in the chart, or Scorpio, or Saturn, those enforced separations from that to which we are attached are a strong part of the life. And the rending process of separation is part of our experience, but then comes compensation, restoration. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote of this. I think he had... an essay on compensation, and the idea was that whatever apparently was taken from you would always be restored, and the universe would always compensate any loss. There can be no true loss of self. The self is absolutely permanent forever. That's the one thing that cannot be lost. You cannot lose yourself. Well, you cannot lose the self. You can lose your artificial self and gain the real self, but the true self cannot be lost. So this is most frequently the problem of parents who are on the path of discipleship, and it is through their children that the lesson is learnt which can release them for initiation. They have to... I saw a movie recently, and I can't remember the name of it, but there were all of these family relationships leading on through the years, and there were deaths and griefs, and then finally at the end of it all, they all seemed to meet on a beach at the shore of an ocean, the endless ocean, and they were all in a grown-up state, not necessarily children or parents to each other, but as if fully grown people who were souls to each other, rather than being in the parental relationship where this kind of attachment we're talking about is more likely found. Then they can relate to each other in a much different way. So through the near ones. So this is a this is a lunar lesson. This is a home, moon, Cancer attachment. And that has to be released, must be released. or we cannot see people as they really are. We just see the form, and so many parents just see the form. I had a Cancerian relative who assured me that she was going to be the most beautiful corpse anyone had ever seen. Maybe going back to Egyptian days, you know, some sort of mummification, but the idea was that she was really going to look good in the casket. Well, I've never been able to forget that. It seems some sort of identification with the form, very strong. So they hold their children to them, and this being counter to the law of nature works out disastrously, and the Christ spoke of this. He said, you have to leave your father and mother and cleave unto your spouse, your husband or your wife. So we know all of the disastrous psychological conditions which arise when a parent holds too strongly a child, or when a child is afraid to leave the parent. You have to be thrown out of the nest at some point for your own welfare. You either leave it or you're thrown out. And if you stay home, there's a warping that occurs. So, because there's no true growth and there's weakness and identification with the smaller world instead of engaging with larger possibilities, one is protected from all one's possible growth when one is kept home like that. So it is the height of selfishness to hold the children formally near one. And yet, did they but know and see aright, they would realize that to hold, one must detach, and to keep, one must release. And this has been popularly spoken, you know, that if you really, really love, you release the thing loved, and if it comes back to you, then it is really yours. It's been spoken in a beautiful way. I can't remember it exactly, but the idea is give freedom, give release, and if according to the law of attraction, that which is released returns to you, it is really yours. It really has affinity, but if you are afraid and you hold tightly to it, you never know whether it's really yours or not. And all kinds of resistance and hatred can build up in such a situation. So to hold, one must detach, and to keep, one must release. This is a great occult principle, really. And for us, the Christ has demonstrated this. He released his hold on form life, and he drew as a result, well, and the Master Jesus, of course, drew all human beings to him. He didn't say, I will and must hold on to you. He released his hold and relinquished all that others hold dear, and then thus through that act demonstrated such a magnetism that so many came to him, which he would not have been able to hold if he had perforce grasped them, as so many teachers do, and say, well, now you're my student. Don't you dare go to another teacher, you know. You are mine. And it's the teachers that say, well, I have something for you, okay. If it is of interest to you, then please attend and apply, but you are free to go where you will. And with that kind of attitude, one, I think, receives more attentiveness from one's students. And thus it is, too, in the parental situation. So many people just don't want to go home because they feel that horrible grasping, stifling attachment of the parental figures. But when the parents say, I love you, go forth into the world, I'll always be with you, I'll always support you, but be free, well then one is only too happy to return to the home where that kind of freeing, loving, liberating attitude has been sourced. Well, okay, where are we? Such is the law. Okay, the soul, okay, has also to learn to relinquish the fruits or gains of service, because when one serves, naturally things of value come to one, and learn to serve without attachment to results, which means to means, to persons, or to praise. This is important. So you serve because you know you're doing the right, and results may emerge or may not emerge or may emerge later. There are many methods of service, and if you become overly attached to any one of them, you will not be flexible enough to recognize other means which may be more suitable for the present circumstances. You serve liberally the many, as Aquarius does, as the sun pours out, and not only certain persons, looking for maybe a personal response. And the server will inevitably have gratitude returned in his or her direction, but this praise, no. One is not serving for the sake of praise. Praise can occasionally give an uplift to the server. You know, there are moments when realizing what you've done for someone can help you do something even better for that person or for others, but it's not for that reason that the service occurs. And he says, with this, I will deal later. So it's not holding on to anything that comes back to you, because if you are grasping something, well, you know, the hands cannot grasp the universe. They can only be the universe. And if you are holding on to things which are of value, then all the other things which are of even greater value cannot come to you. And you cannot learn to identify as the larger whole. So we could say that grasping prevents us from identifying as the larger whole. We have some limited kind of attachment and not the being of the larger whole. I'm remembering that Mary Bailey always used to say in the matter of donations, she would say, well, don't specify what the amount must be, because then you close the door on a possibly more generous contribution. So it's out of fear that one says, well, it has to be this. But if one trusts, then that which can and will support what is needed will come. Anyway, this will be, I think, the end of Laws of the Soul, webinar commentaries number 8, EP2. I hope this is number 8, not number 7. I think so. I think it is. Yes, it is. And we are on page 105, I think. 106 begins right here. So, page 105. And beginning of Laws of the Soul in our commentaries number 9. Same page. And we will move on to that. Well, we've had a couple of several relinquishments here, haven't we? So, what are the relinquishments we've had? This is secondly. Let's mark it firstly, secondly. Secondly, relinquish the ties to other personal selves. And firstly, firstly what? Oh, there's second. Now, where is first? Hoping to find it. Yes, there it is. Relinquish the personality altogether. Okay, so this is relinquishing the personality altogether. And then the ties to other personal selves. And there is a third type of relinquishment here. I'm not sure whether it says thirdly. Maybe not. Okay, yes. The third is to relinquish the fruits or gains of service. Okay, so, third, relinquish fruits or gains of service. And then when we start number 9, we will talk about the relinquishing of the sense of responsibility for that which other disciples do. That may be a hard one. It seems so easy to fall into that particular trap. So we will go on with that at the next moment, and for now, that will be all for this particular little program. We'll see you soon. Okay, bye-bye.